Good evening, everybody. It's my pleasure to welcome all of you to tonight's lecture. It's a particular personal pleasure to welcome Rav Avital Hachsin, who is the president of Machon Adar Israel, and therefore is often, if not almost entirely, in Israel. But we get to merit her presence in this Beit Midrash during the summer. And it's also the opportunity that I have to learn in Chavruta with her, which allows me to learn Torah in a much more sensitive and careful way than I get to do almost any other time. So I'm more than excited to welcome Rav Avital to give tonight's lecture. Thank you.
Thank you all for being here. I have a lot of appreciation for my colleagues and students here at Hadal who push my Torah forward, and I just want to start with that recognition and thanks. What I want to think about together this evening is a subject that's critical to our project, the project of a life of Torah, Torah that is manifested in learning chesed and tefillah, and this Torah as it expresses itself and lives in the modern world. It's critical because what I want to examine are tools that enable the bridge between Torah and what is current. Since what is current changes, also the prism and the tools that enable Torah to be a basic guiding force in our lives, all those also need to be revisited, re-examined, and probably manipulated and changed. Great, you have your sources. Kennedy, in his commencement address at Yale University in 62, said the following, and it's the first source on your pages. Too often, we hold fast to the cliches of our forebears. We subject all facts to a prefabricated set of interpretations. We enjoy the comfort of opinion without the discomfort of thought. Mythology distracts us everywhere, for the great enemy of the truth is very often not a lie, deliberate, contrived, and dishonest, but a myth, persistent, persuasive, and unrealistic. This is a call for innovation and a critical perception of tradition. Tradition, which is defined here by Kennedy as the cliches of our forebears. He puts forth several challenges to those of us who regard tradition with reverence, those of us who understand tradition as a language, a philosophy, and a set of values with which to live today. How do we make sure to perceive the facts around us, not through prefabricated interpretations, but with fresh ones that are nonetheless still connected to past experiences and wisdom? How do we make sure that our traditional opinions, our culture's traditional sentiments and ideas are re-examined without untethering our connection to the past? And mythology. How do we turn a guiding this mythology into a guiding force rather than let it distract us? Myths are so great. They're the prism through which we understand who we are as people and as Jews. Eating from the forbidden tree in the Garden of Eden is what brought people to have choice between good and bad. Trying to build the tower in Babylonian tower was the prelude to a rich, diverse, multicultural humanity. How do we keep alive these notions of who we are and let them persist, but in the same time continue to be dynamic, enabling change? So I read Kennedy's words, and I identify with his challenges, despite being, I assume, like him, someone who finds wealth of wisdom in myths and richness of thought in my forebearers' cliches and comfort in many of their notions. So this evening, I want to discuss some attitudes, some guidelines, some philosophies that suggest tools and prisms that give forth meaningful bridges between past and present, between tradition and innovation. I also want to say a personal note of why this challenge is important to me. I imagine my great-grandfather, who I never met, looking down at what I'm doing. And sometimes I feel that he's furious, and sometimes I hope that he's proud. And I feel the tension between how he forbade my grandmother to learn Hebrew, and here I am learning it, and forbade my grandmother to take part in active Jewish life, and here I am not only playing an active role, but also daring to try and teach and learn. And I feel that tension physically. And I want to believe that there is a way to be a continuity rather than a break with that Judaism that he was living and believing in and understanding. And I want to say one last thing by way of introduction to the challenge of the evening. I believe that the Jewish community today is at arms over issues of boundaries. Who is in and who is out? What behavior can be tolerated and what not? What type of prayer can the Kotel tolerate and what is unbearable for that Kotel wall of ours? And I think that that's part of the question at hand. We have a responsibility to define the bridge that we are building between past and present so that we have a language for the Judaism that we are living as internal to our tradition. And so with that challenge, I enter what I want to do this evening. And what I want to do is simply offer three or four interpretations of very different texts. And first of all, just experience the art of interpretation together with you. And second of all, as I was learning these texts, what I realized was that each almost technical tool of interpretation was coupled with a notion, a philosophy, a paradigm of continuity and change, of that bridge between past and present. And so I want to think of both of the practical, maybe technical tools of interpretation and of the content that is derived through each one of them. And of course, when we start at the beginning, we start with Eve. And I want to start with a verse that describes Eve realizing the tree of knowledge and her not being allowed to eat of it when the snake presents her with the tree. And the verse that I want us to read together describes her kind of suddenly becoming aware of the tree. Maybe somebody's willing to read the verse. English, Hebrew, whatever is comfortable for you. Thank you.
When the woman saw that the tree was good for eating and a delight to the eye, and that the tree was pleasant for wisdom, she took of its fruit and ate. She also gave some to her husband, and he ate.
Great. Thank you. So traditional commentators try to explain why Eve gave from the fruit to Adam. I'll read first the Avot de Rabbi Natan, which I'm afraid I have only in Hebrew, and I'll translate as I go. V'yesh omrim, and there are those who say, Kevan she'achla chava miperotav shel ilan, since Chava ate from the fruit of the tree, ra'ata mal'ach ha'mavet sheba kenegda. She saw the angel of death walking towards her. Amra, doma ani ke'ilu she'ani mistaleket min ha'olam. It seems that I'm about to die. V'sof livrot acheret le'adam rishon tachtai. And probably there will be created another Eve, another woman for Adam instead of me. Ma'ani osa, what should I do? גורמת אני לו שיוכל עמי. I will cause him to eat together with me. As it says, ותיקח מפריו, she took from the fruit of the tree, ותאכל, and she ate. ותיתן גם לאישה אימה, and she gave also to the man who was with her, and he ate. And Rashi echoes this midrash, and maybe that we'll read in the English, and she gave also to her husband. It's the next page I hear from all the turning pages. the top of page 2, so that she should not die and he remain alive to take another wife. Okay, so Rashi echoes the Midrash. The interpretations are very similar. According to both, Eve's motives were sinister. I recently heard Carol Gilligan suggest a very different read of this verse. She starts her interpretation by noticing Eve's experience of the tree. Right? What does the verse tell us of Eve's experience? Tova et, right? It was a good tree. Ta'avau la'inayim, nechmad, it's nice, it's pleasant. As most people, when we encounter something good, what do? We want to share it with those we love. And so because the tree was so good and the experience of the fruit was so delicious, Eve, as a good person would, shared it with Adam. That is, of course, a very different read of the motivation behind Eve's, Chava's, sharing of the fruit. First of all, it uses a relational lens. Okay, what motivates Chava, according to Carol Gilligan's read, is her relationship with Adam. An attitude of love and kindness is what shapes the attempt to understand what motivates Chava, what motivates Eve. And so I think one basic tool of interpretation is noticing people's experiences, and maybe I need to be a bit more precise. It's noticing other people's experiences. We know that often women, or whoever isn't men, are perceived as other. And so if we take into account other people's experiences, maybe the way we understand and interpret the world and also our texts will very much change. And a second basic tool of interpretation is to put on the lens and the prism of relationships as motivator. So that's interpretation number one. I'd like to go on to a very different type of text, a Tanaitic source, a source from the period of the Mishnah, which offers once again an interpretation of a verse. What's going to be interesting about this example is that the reinterpretation that we're going to find is already within the within the Talmudic tradition. Okay, and let's read together the Tosefta. Maybe again, I'll ask somebody else to read. We'll read. It's a long section. So we'll read only from the part that is underlined in number 4. Who would like to read for us? Thank you.
Those that are composed in collections, Ba'alei Asufot, these are those who enter and sit in groups, Asufot, and declare what is ritually impure. And declare what is ritually pure, pure. The pure in its place and the impure in its place.
Go on.
Lest a person say in his opinion, since Beit Shammai declare impure and Beit Hillel declare pure, so-and-so forbids and so-and-so permits. Why would I study Torah based on that? That's why the verse says words. The words. These are the words. All of the words. One more?
Yeah.
Given from one shepherd, one God created them, one leader gave them, the master of deeds, blessed be he, said them. So too you make your heart into many chambers and bring into it the words of Beit Shammai and the words of Beit Hillel, the words of those who declare impure and the words of those who declare pure.
Great, thank you. Okay, so I want to just spend a few minutes delving into this text. First of all, in the sense of its mission. Its mission is to interpret the verse from Kohelet. So if you look back to page 2, 1a, Moving Traditions, right? We have a verse from Kohelet. דברי חכמים כדורבנות, כמסמרות נטועים בעלי אסופות ניתנו מרואה אחד. It's those verses that are totally ununderstandable and cryptic that are the best foundation for Midrash. Okay, and this is a great example of that. And so the Midrash really takes apart each one of the words and with its almost free association gives it interpretation. You'll see section 1 has the beginning of the quote, right? Section 2 ends with the word masmerot, section 3 with the word netuim, and then section 4 starts with the next words of ba'alei asufot. So that's just in the sense of the structure of the Midrash and what it's doing. Now let's spend a minute on the content of number 4. Section 4 describes this amazingly harmonious Bet Midrash, right? Everyone is sitting there, all these groups of people and learning, and everyone says about X that it's tameh, and everyone says about Y that it's tahor. And there's a joint flow happening within this Bet Midrash. Not only are there no disputes in this Bet Midrash, but there seems to be no doubt in this Bet Midrash. Okay, everything is just flowing in harmony. And now we arrive to section 5, and the energy feels different. Something seems out of sync, not going with the flow. First of all, we're no longer interpreting the verse, right? There's nothing in section 5 that is anchored back to the verse in Kohelet. Okay, so there's a technical problem here in the flow of the Midrash. But also, this Bet Midrash suddenly seems to be chaotic. Okay, it's true that we have discrete bodies of knowledge. Bet Shammai say this, Bet Hillel say this, but the person is left perplexed as to what to do. Okay, there is chaos happening here, and the person doesn't know how to function. Okay, Lama ani lamed Torah me'ata. Why or how am I going to learn Torah in this reality? Just to stay for 1 minute in the technical strain of the Midrash, section 6, just to confuse us, goes back to the verse, okay, right? Nitnu meroe echad, seemingly not connected to section 5 at all, okay? And section 7, again, leaves the verse and doesn't relate to it at all. So what's happening here? Shlomo Na'e, when reading this Midrash, suggests that there's two issues being dealt with that are entwined in these four sections, both of them relating to Torah and to Aral Torah, and to challenges that Torah and Aral Torah present us with. First of all, sections 1, 2, 3, 4, and 6, the ones that deal with the verse. Okay? Those sections basically answer in beautiful and poetic terms the question of the source of Aral Torah. Okay, if we look just at sources, we'll stick to 4 and 6, which are the ones we read, right? We have a description of these groups of people learning, and then the bottom line in section 6 is they were all given from one shepherd. One person created them, one entity created them. Okay, they all have one source, all these varied notions. So that's question number 1. The second section, which is really made up of 5 and 7, not connected to the verse at all, attempts to approach the question of the quantity of Torah. There is so much Torah at hand. How am I going to learn? What am I going to do with all this body of knowledge? I'm drowning. It's chaos. Okay, that's the question in number 5. How am I going to learn Torah when there's so much of it? And the response is, Dvarim, Hadvarim, Ele Hadvarim. Compartmentalize, organize Torah. That is how you deal with the quantity, with the overflowing chaos of knowledge that there is. create structures to hold them in. That's the answer in section 5. And once again, that's the answer in number 7. Right? You should make yourself a heart of many chambers. And you should be able to organize the different sections of Torah that you have, where it's Bet Shammai, where it's Bet Hillel, where it's pure, where it's impure, and so on and so forth. This is based on a verse which starts with the words Ele HaDvarim, these are the words, which is actually the verse that opens the book of Dvarim. What's unique about the book of Dvarim is that the person speaking is Moshe. So it's the beginning of Mishneh Torah. It's the beginning of the creation of the Oral Torah. These are the things that Moshe spoke to the whole of Israel. And that is the basis for the claim that also Oral Torah came from Moshe. And so this is basically a text that makes two claims. One is also Oral Torah came from the one divine source. And how do you deal with the multiplicity, the quantity of Torah? You organize it. That is your role. Now I want to see what happened to this text in a later iteration of it, no longer in the period of the Mishnah in a Tannaitic environment, but in the Talmudic sources. And that's the next source on your page. I'll ask somebody to read, again, sections 4, 5, 6, and 7. And the question I'll ask you after we're finished reading is if you can point out some differences between the Tannaitic source and the Tosefta that we just read and the Talmudic source that we're about to read. Okay? Ayelet, do you want to read the next part for us also? Great.
So, number 4 on page 4. Those that are composed in collections, Balei Asufot. These are Torah scholars who sit in many groups, Asufot, and engage in Torah study. There are often debates among these groups, as some of these sages render an object or person ritually impure, and these render it pure. These prohibit an action, and these permit it. These deem an item invalid, and these deem it valid. Lest a person say, now, how can I study Torah when it contains so many different opinions? The verse states that they are all given from one shepherd. One God gave them, one leader, i.e. Moshe, said them from the mouth of the master of all creation, blessed be he, as it is written, and God spoke all these words. The plural form words indicates that God transmitted all the interpretations of the Ten Commandments. Since the sages invariably utilize the Torah itself, or the statements of the prophets as the sources for their opinions, there is a certain unity to the study of Torah, despite the numerous explanations and applications. So to you, the student, make your ears like a funnel and acquire for yourself an understanding heart to hear both the statements of those who render objects ritually impure and the statements of those who render them pure. The statements of those who prohibit actions and the statements of those who permit them, the statements of those who deem items invalid and the statements of those who deem them valid.
Great, thank you. So now take a minute to look at the two texts. What differences were striking that you can point out to? Yes.
The syntax in the second is considerably clearer.
I would say that might be the fact that different people may have translated both, but okay.
Translation is much more modern,
elaborate
than
the first. Perfect. Yes.
Well, in the Bavli, the division of what is number 4 and what is number 5 is significant because it takes some of those phrases, like the Matirin and the Osrin, that were part of number 5 in the Tosefta, but ties them into the teaching about Balei Asufot. So that's the difference of what is connected to this verse and what is not, which seems to me significant.
Great. Good. So first of all, number 5 is much, much shorter, right, in the Talmud, okay, that you're right. All these pieces of bodies of knowledge that were connected to the question aren't there anymore.
Well, they're in number four.
They're in number four. They were in number four also in the previous text. What? Right? Okay, so the question is, are there differences in the way these groupings are described? Okay, what's the reality expressed in the two number fours that we have before us, right? We said before that in the Tosefta, the earlier text, it seems like this very harmonious Bet Midrash. That is not the feeling of number four in the Bavli that we just read.
Number four says there are often debates.
Right, there are debates.
Discomfort, they don't just agree. Yeah, what's that?
Perfect, they're debates, they're disputes, right? These guys are saying tameh, and these guys are saying tahor. These guys are saying it's forbidden, these guys are saying it's allowed, all in one Bet Midrash. Whereas before, it seemed that everyone was in agreement with what the verdict is. The description here is of a Bet Midrash that has disputes. Okay, so that's one big difference, yes.
I also think that the fact that the last text states on top of pure and pure, prohibited, permitted, makes it very applicable. Because if we are looking at the text sort of from a distance, okay, pure and impure not exactly relate to us, but prohibited and permitted is related to every person at every moment.
Great.
Excuse me, the word debates is only in the English. It's not in the original text.
You're 100% correct that it's not there, and yet the Oskim BaTorah, it might be an attempt for the Oskim BaTorah, right, which is in the Hebrew, and isn't there in the English. I imagine that that's where it came from, right? That it's an interpretation of Oskim BaTorah, which would be literally dealing with Torah, learning Torah, something like that, okay? And we still have the halalu vehalalu, these and these, divided into two different groups, whereas in four, in the Tosefta, they're described as working together, okay? Jeremy, you wanted to comment? Yes.
Also, in the first one, they mentioned two rabbis. In the second one, it just has so many people. It mentioned Shammai and Hillel, and in the second one, just has so many different opinions without mentioning the rabbi's name.
Yeah.
It implies that there's now more and more people discussing it other than Shammai and Hillel.
Yeah. Okay, beautiful. I also wonder if it means that Shammai and Hillel are a way to categorize and organize information. And I think that's what the first text was about, whereas this one is raising a different issue. And so the identity of those disputing maybe becomes less important, and the fact of the dispute is more present. Okay, Yofi, great, yes.
I just noticed that if the Talmud text refers to the people who are debating as Talmidei Chachamim, like scholars, and the text from the Tosefta just calls them like the people who walk in the big trash, like sit in the groups, like it seems like they're getting their legitimacy.
Right. I was thinking about that also in the context of the previous comment of the Asur and Mutar. It might also be just words from a different world, right? From the Babylonian world that we feel more comfortable with. So you're calling it legitimacy, and maybe it's just because our biases are of the later texts. Okay. Great. Okay. Yes, Analia.
I was going to say, the one thing that strikes me is number 7 for both of them. I mean, one, you're supposed to bring this information into this heart of many chambers. And then the second one, you're actually supposed to form an understanding part. You're supposed to digest the information and look to interpret it. And I think it's a nice difference. We're thinking about a big address that's sort of harmonious and a lot of information, but that's sort of clear-cut, versus something that's a little bit more chaotic. You're trying to sort of dissect it and understand it.
Right, from a person who's an expert in information, right? Yes.
I think the first one they say, why would I study Torah if everything was already decided? And the second one is, how do I study this when all these different opinions are coming up?
Tell me again how you understood the first. Why?
The first one says mama. It says, why would I study Torah?
Right.
If this is what it's like. And the other one is, how do I study Torah when there are so many different opinions?
Right, so it feels like the questions are different. And I don't know if the challenge is why study if everything's decided, or how am I going to deal with this if there's so much of it? Like, I can't take control over it. And you're right, the second challenge is, with all these disputes, how am I going to make sense of this? Okay? Yofi, so let's try and summarize for a minute. I'll just point out a few differences. You want to make a last comment?
I just wanted to add one thing because I feel like it's really pertinent to what you said before, that in the Bavli in part six, it like makes the point that you were making about Moses. It first of all, it extrapolates from, they're all from God, and Moses set them all, mm-hmm. and that Moses gave all these different interpretations. I feel like it was getting at
what right.
we were talking about. Like, this takes a quote from Shmot, but still the idea that...
So those of you who follow the Hebrew will see that six, there's a lot of elaboration there that isn't in the Hebrew text at all. I think a difference that you're pointing to, and I do want to make mention of, is that the verses that we're basing ourselves on in the two different texts are different. Whereas in the first text that we saw, right, we said it was the opening verse from the book of Devarim. Whereas in this text, we're looking at a verse from Shmot, which is the opening verse to the Ten Commandments. Okay, we're in a totally different place. It's somebody else who's speaking, okay, obviously, and it's the opening verse of the Ten Commandments. So now let's see if we can get the picture of what's happening here in the source in the Bavli. So as we said, section 4 describes just a very different reality, no longer harmonious, but a Bet Midrash that is divided, has within it dispute. And from this reality, the question stems in number 5 of how am I going to learn? And maybe I'm asking myself about the how versus the why. Maybe this reality of dispute brings forth the question of why. Why should I learn if there's so many opinions and I can't get to a bottom line? Okay, so the how and the why here play, I think, side by side. The response in section 6, okay, so also we see that there's a flow here. Unlike before where we felt like 4 and 6 were connected and 5 and 7 were connected, this is much more edited and there's a direct flow 4, 5, and 6, and 7. And the response in section 6 is a claim that Torah, with its conflicting and disputing voices, was all given at Sinai. I imagine that that's a notion we've heard in many different ways and versions, right? One of the most famous ones is Elu ve'elu divrei Elohim chayim, right? It's all the words of the living God. Okay, but here, kulam nitnu miro'eh echad. They were all given from one shepherd. Okay, that is why I learned Torah. That is how I can continue learning Torah, because I know that also the disputing opinions stem from the one God. Now, section 7 is interesting here because it's not a directive to compartmentalize the bodies of knowledge, but rather a directive to listen and understand fully each opinion. Okay, it's a directive that is completely connected to the world of dispute. My responsibility in a world of dispute is to actually understand each opinion fully. That is what I need to do as a learner. Okay, aseh oznecha ke'afar keset. Open up your ear and have an understanding heart. Right? It's not an organizing heart. It's an understanding heart to each one of the opinions. And so one of the most, I think, basic bridges between my world, our world, and our traditional text is, first of all, the fact that we come from an interpretive tradition. Okay, we have here an example of a Tanaitic source that was reshaped and reinterpreted in a very different way with the challenges that the Talmudic reality felt. And that's the first thing that we see here. But there's also an issue of content that comes up here that is very relevant and connected and demonstrated here. And that is that we are a Torah of multiplicity of opinions, and that our Torah can hold that multiplicity of opinions. That is an encouragement for somebody trying to come up with a new interpretation, both encouragement and legitimacy, okay? And somewhat of a roadmap of how to navigate this reality. I'm going to go on to a third type of text, but I want to give opportunity for any questions or thoughts if people want to share at this point. Yes.
I'm just wondering, when you were talking about 5 and 7 initially not being connected to the verse, I heard that it was relating back to the idea of Divrei Chachamim, and that it was pulling on the opening of the Kohelet verse as like Divrei Chachamim. the metaphor is somehow about the diversity of the great Hachamimi. So I'm wondering if that, if you, like, why you separate its use of, it just felt like Dvarim and Dibrei was so central.
Right. Okay, look, first of all, just on a technical level, all the other pieces so beautifully connect to the verse, and these two very sharply don't. Now, you're right. Somebody weaved them together because they weren't part of the same fabric and notion and idea. And now we have the challenge of figuring out what, and was this weaving done well or not so well? Was it kept purposely maybe a little bit out of sync so that I notice that there's two really questions here at hand. One is the source of the oral Torah, and the other is how do I deal with all this information, right? Because it's answering different questions, right? The bottom line in six is it all comes from God. And the bottom line in five and seven is here's how you should deal with it. Okay, so it's answering different questions. Yeah, I think that's my basic response. Okay. The third example I want to give, I want to say the following thing by way of introduction. There are new, modern, postmodern notions that enrich Torah. And part of the bridge that we can all do, that I do on a regular basis, is to use the new lenses that I have to understand in different and new ways the old texts. And that's something that I want to demonstrate with the following text. The text is a cluster of verses that deal with the wild and unruly child, Ben Sorer Umori. It's page 5, source number 8. And once again, I'm going to pose a question as you listen to the verses being read. The question is the following. When we have a law, right, the law is usually made up of a description of a case and then a verdict regarding that case, right? Makeh ish vamet, that's a description of the case. Somebody hits somebody else and the person dies. And now comes the verdict, mot yumat, he's put to death. Okay? So what I'm curious to hear from you here is, where do you think that shift happens in this verses? Where does the description of the case end and the verdict of what the person is obligated to do in this reality come up? Okay? And once again, maybe I'll ask somebody else to read English or Hebrew, whatever is comfortable. Yes, please.
Ki yeleish ben sorer umore, einenu shomer bekol aviv bekol imo, veisru oto velo ishma lehem.
Great, thank you. So what do you think? Where does the description of the case end and the verdict begin? Jeremy?
I'm going to go with verse 21.
Verse 21.
Because they're doing all these things. The parents came to the elders and they said these things. What should you do then? You should, all the people of the town should stone him.
Perfect. Okay, so that makes a lot of sense, right? We have this kid, we bring him to court. If he's found guilty, then the verdict is stoning. Okay, great. Is there another suggestion? Yeah?
I would say that it's actually after the first line. So the first line is the situation, and starting at 19 is the verdict. Mm-hmm. Because I'm just looking at the, I'm looking at the English, though.
The English is fine. No, no.
Because this is his father and mother shall take him. So it seems like that's giving the directive of what they're supposed to do in when they have this child.
Great. I have to say, it's a great exact read of the language. What's tricky in the Hebrew is that all we have there is and. Okay, the language doesn't change as much as you're pointing out. And yet, I want to hold on to your suggestion for a minute. So play it out. What's the case and what's the verdict?
Well, I think that the case is that they have a defiant child. I mean, so great. I think it still holds. I think the case is that they have this defiant child, mm-hmm. and that the response, what they're supposed to do, is take the child to the community or consult the elders of the community on what should be done. Though right. I guess in the time of this, that this is written, it would have been maybe more common to take them to the elders. Well, if we're thinking modern interpretation, you might not have taken the child. I don't know if that makes sense. But I'm saying, like, I think that I'm recognizing that I'm bringing maybe a modern context.
No, don't back up from what you're saying. I think what you're saying is important. We'll go back to it in a minute. You had another suggestion? No, with the other hands? Yes.
Yeah, I think it starts before the first pasuk, before 18. Because I think it's even though it's a hypothetical, it's already predetermined. There is no real court case here. They're sort of, the parents are bringing the kid is like diagnosed with these, you know, behavioral issues. And like, there's no going back at that point. At that point, by virtue of them saying that, it's a done deal, and then they have to follow this protocol.
This is my thought about it. It's very interesting. I think we don't, right, when I quoted before the law, makeh ish vamet mot yumat, somebody strikes somebody else and the person dies, he should be put to death. Do we assume that there's a court case deciding that he actually murdered and then getting witnesses and so on? Or do we assume that it's a done deal and that there's no choice? I think we assume a court case. So it's interesting. You're not the first person to suggest this read with these verses. And I think it's interesting that there's something about this case that we don't assume due process. Okay? You go ahead, yeah?
I think in the Tvari iteration of this scene, there doesn't seem to be a court case, but I think I don't want to steal your, I don't know where you're going with this, but it's also possible that the court case becomes a little bit more elaborate and a little bit more complicated in later interpretations of the text.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. I think all I want to say is that I think very rarely does it say in the Torah, and there is a court case, and they decide, and I think it's a sensitive read, and it's interesting to me, reading these verses with different people, that here it's very striking to us. Okay. Yes?
I think the reason it doesn't seem like there's a court case is because we're given every step in the proceedings. Normally, with like makeh ish, there's a noticeable gap there between the person striking someone and dying, and where I will be put to death.
Right.
Whereas here, it seems like you have
there's so much detail
in the case.
Right.
So it's hard to put one in.
Yeah. I'm trying to think if there's any v'yashvu. I guess there is sometimes in later sources v'yashvu as kinim, right? Some that they're sitting and deliberating, but not that common, and maybe not in the Torah. Okay, great. Any other attempts anyone wants to make?
I just thought there were two phases of verdicts here.
Okay.
First, they described what the kid did. Then the parents made a verdict. They decided this was a bad kid and had to do something. They took it to the court, and then there was a second phase of verdict, which was what the court did.
With the court. Good. What strengthens that read is that there's an implication to the parents' verdict, which is ve'yisru oto, that they themselves discipline him, right? So they decide that he is in need of discipline, okay? And of course, that would be the earliest place that we could say maybe the verdict starts, right? If I have a wild and unruly child, maybe I have to discipline him, okay? Because now I want to, 1 minute, just make explicit the implication of where we put the decision, where we decide that that's the verdict. If we decide that's the verdict, that means we have no choice there, okay? It means, for example, if I continue the suggestion that was made here, that it's in verse 19, if I have a wild and unruly child, and I discipline the kid, and it doesn't work, and continuing to not listen to me, if I put the verdict in verse 19, I have no choice but to take the child out of the home to the court. Okay? That is the verdict. That's what I have to do. Okay? In modern language, I would say the social worker has to come into the house at that point. Okay? There has to be intervention. Okay, there has to be intervention. Yes.
Right, which means that they were hoping that the court would save the child, that they'd have something that they didn't know how to do to intervene. In other words, they're the next level up. And then they could have intervened where the parents couldn't have.
I'm going to go back to that suggested read of yours in a minute. Okay, great. You wanted to still make a comment, Amanda?
So I struggle with reading. I struggle with some of the thoughts with the understanding that, like, I'm not entirely sure if they're getting into a court or if they're getting into a court of public opinion. I think, like, you asked the question in such a way that, like, it kind of demanded a reading of, like, this is this, and immediately after that is a verdict, and I'm not sure that's right. I think that your case can, like, start in 18. I think that you inherently have a process, whether it's due or not, it's different. But I would almost liken it to a contract of, like, they go together and they say, like, this is the process for, like, how to deal with this thing. I want to evict my son. I understand that he's getting stoned. I want to evict my son, like, because, like, X, Y, and Z, and this is the process to do this, and I go here. And, like, I understand, like, thickening, like, it could have been, like, the elders of the town. It, like, doesn't say a Beit Din here. It doesn't say, like, you know, like, this is, like, 100%, like, and perhaps that's why you don't have, like, a due process court. But more interestingly, like, when you finally get to this idea of, like, a verdict, or this idea of potentially a verdict at 21, like, the Zikanin here, like, it doesn't say anything about them. The parents are supposed to say this, and then it doesn't go back to the Zikanin. It doesn't talk about, like, what their verdict is, or it doesn't have them say anything at all. Instead, you have this court of public opinion, where you have it say, Kolhan Sheiglo, like, all of the people of the town, all the men of the town, go out and stone him. And so, I'm struggling a little with either your question or kind of the way that it's being answered. But I don't know that it, like, sets up as a court case. I think that, like, you've really set it up as, like, they go, they complain, we don't actually really have an answer, and then the people take it into their own hands.
I do think the Zakanian means a court. Like, that's what it means here. Like, Zakanian is synonymous with a Beit Din.
But even if that's so, you have no verdict from that.
Yeah, the verdict is they have to study.
But they don't.
Yeah, but that was what I was saying earlier, like, that most of the time in the Torah you don't get the court says they're guilty. That's assumed, otherwise they wouldn't be stoning.
I think it goes back, Behemet, like you're saying, Jeremy, to the previous question that you suggested. So first of all, skenim are code word for court. In the vast majority of times, maybe in all of them. And I think you guys are right. And maybe the explanation offered before maybe explained it. There's so much elaborated here, and so we would expect that there be a statement of, and they sat and they deliberated. And it's missing because so much else is elaborated. But I think we have to assume that there was an option here to decide either way, that that's what a court does. And so the verdict is, if he is found guilty, then you stone him. Okay, that's right, reading it to the most extreme of regamuhu, that's where the verdict is. Up till that point, we have choice. We don't have to take him out to the skenim. The skenim don't necessarily have to find him guilty. But if they do, this is what happens. Okay, so that's the kind of the one extreme way of reading these verses. Versus the other, which I want to focus on for 1 minute, in verse 19. And I want to say it in modern terms. Basically, there's a move here from the private to the public domain. And I don't have choice with that move. Okay, I'm being told that there's some issues that happen in the private sphere that I have no choice but to take out into the public sphere. Okay, now let's understand what that means. Okay, and I want to suggest that there's different ways to understand that demand or that move. Let's start with Kate Millett, who's on the bottom of page 5. Kate Millett has the following understanding of the role of the family. The chief contribution of the family in patriarchy is the socialization of the young, largely through the example and admonition of their parents into patriarchal ideology. as cooperation between the family and the larger society is essential, else both would fall apart, the fate of the three patriarchal institutions, the family, society, and the state, are interrelated. Now, if we take a minute to Kate Millett's understanding of the role of the family within society, she is basically calling for a blurring of the differences between private and public. And she basically says the entities that are seemingly private and those that are seemingly public, they all come to serve the same thing, the patriarch. There's the little patriarch at home, there's the big patriarch not at home, and the hand of the law goes into the home for one reason and one reason only. There's a child who's questioning authority of the patriarch, and I have to take care of that child. Okay? That's the way she would read this law. The purpose of this law is to protect the great patriarch. Okay. Comes Catherine MacKinnon and agrees that we should blur the lines between the private and the public, but for very, very different reasons. The liberal ideal of the private holds that so long as the public does not interfere, autonomous individuals interact freely and equally. Abstract privacy protects abstract autonomy without inquiring into whose freedom of action is being sanctioned at whose expense. Okay? MacKinnon here is being very critical of the notion of privacy, basically claiming that privacy gives power to those who are powerful and doesn't protect those elements in society who are weak, and that under the guise of privacy, a lot of evils can happen. We know that often a home can be a place where a lot of power is exerted in unjust ways. And so she criticizes kind of letting go of the home with the eye of the law. And she says the role of the law is to go into the home and to control what happens there for one reason, to protect those elements that are weak. And so she would read the law of Ben Soer Umore as having one person in mind, the child. I want to make sure that it's not the father who's deciding alone what's going to happen to this kid, but actually that he's taken out into the public sphere and there taken care of, or they're punished if need be, but not to leave it in the hands of the father. There are those who say that this is an internal biblical development, whereas Abraham can sacrifice Isaac, and Yehudah can put Tamar to death, right? All parents with their children or with their children-in-law. This is an internal biblical development that puts kind of the brakes and stops the father from having control over the life of the child, okay? And so, again, blurs the line between the private and the public in order to protect the weak. Okay, so that's a second suggestion of how to read this law. I want to offer a third one, which goes actually according, I think, to the lines that you were suggesting. Cultural feminism would call us not to let go of the distinction between private and public, but actually to take advantage of it, and would make the following suggestion. Where is this child of Ben Soer? By definition, this child is a Ben Soer at home. That's how I define his identity as Soer is defined in his behavior vis-a-vis his parents. Once I remove him out into the court, I can suddenly understand what he's doing differently. By definition, he's not acting vis-a-vis his parents, even if he's acting in exactly the same way. The context has changed, and so the definition of what he's doing is different. And so maybe take advantage of the difference between the private and the public. Move this child outside into the court, and now maybe a meeting between parents and child can happen. Maybe some interaction can happen. Maybe even for those of you who know the Talmudic discussion here, that is the meaning of lo haya velo atid liot, that there will never be a wild and unruly child, because if I follow the word of the law, I am not going to enable him to continue and exist as a wild and unruly child, right? But remove him from the home. Okay. Any questions or thoughts that you want to share at this point before I go one more step? Yes.
What you said before about the two different, the little patriarchy and the little patriarch and the grand scale patriarch, because even though this is an improvement from the Akedah, from the other instances where the father could in theory take action, it's still putting the punishment or the verdict in the hands of the larger patriarch. So I think that there's some, I'm hesitant to put a more sort of progressive lens on this as something that's really,
right,
you know, has made
huge strides. Yeah. I have two thoughts about that. One is that I sometimes think of it as it's the power of the weak, okay? You're right, it's limited power, but it is some protective eye. And the second is that, of course, we strive towards courts that aren't patriarchal, okay? So in that regard, and we have to add in here also one more thing, that there is the voice of the mother, which plays a very, very central role, both in the verses and later in the Talmudic discussion. And there, you have to think if she actually is a rubber stamp or she has agency.
Right. I don't necessarily expect it to be a non-patriarchal environment, but yeah. It's interesting that the mother has a role in the beginning, but the Zikneiro are not necessarily part.
Are clearly there's no women there, yeah. In their reality, there's no question. Yeah. Yes.
So it seems to me the verses themselves go with Kate Millett's interpretation, so they didn't really focus on the Poshayishma Uviyaru. In other words, the little patriarchy and big patriarchy are conspiring together to make sure that everybody's terrorized into supporting the patriarchy.
Right. Right. You could say that, or you could say, Kol Yisraelishma Uviyarau, fathers, beware, you can never do like Abraham again. So you could read it both ways. Yeah. Nachon. Any other thoughts? I think what I want to just stress in the sense of this interpretation is that I think that using new language and new prisms, for example, just the awareness of the distinction between the private and the public realm, which are new kind of prism through which to read, enrich our Torah. Suddenly we have three different ways to understand this one law. And now going into the Talmudic discussion with these three different reads, okay, just brings forth to a lot of richness. And we could perceive these new understandings as a break from the tradition, and actually I'm encouraging us to kind of take some of our new languages and sensibilities with us when we read these old texts as one form of interpretation. Okay, I'm going to give a last example in the time that we have left. The last example I want to give is a halachic text. It's a text that is a legal text. And the goal of this text is to connect between law and verses, or connect actually from verses to laws. And it's called a midrash halacha, okay? A legal read of verses. And I want to give two examples. And the explicit goal of these two examples is to include women in certain situations. So let's just start by looking at that and how that happens. Let's look at example number 13, towards the bottom of page 6. Atem. The word atem is the first word quoted. You have in the English the entire verse. None of you shall go outside the doors of this house until morning. It is the command on the children of Israel not to leave their homes on the night of Makat Bechorot. How do you say Makat Bechorot? Slaying of the firstborn. Thank you. Okay. En li ela atem. I only know that this refers to you. gerim, nashim, ve'avadim, minayin? How does one know from the scripture that this refers as well to, don't know if this is converts or strangers, women and slaves? In other words, how do I know that these other social groups were not allowed to leave the home that night either? Talmud lomar ve'atem lo tetzu. The scripture states, and none of you shall go outside. Okay. What's the bottom line here? Bottom line is nobody could leave the house. Not you, which is probably Israeli men, citizens, okay, free, okay? And then we're including in the slaves, the women, and the converts or the strangers as also groups of people who could not leave their home that night. Great. Let's read one more example, and then we'll go back and ask a couple of questions. Let's read example 15. Kotev alchu et bnei Yisrael, and this is how you shall bless the children of Israel. This is a statement made to Aharon and his sons of Birkat Kohanim, the blessing that the Kohanim give the children of Israel. I have not but a blessing unto Israel. A blessing unto strangers, converts, women, and slaves from where? Okay, how do I know that when the Kohanim give Birkat Kohanim, they're blessing not only the free citizens, the men, but also slaves, women, strangers, from where? As it states, in order to teach, and I shall bless them. Talmud lomar, ve'ani avarchem. Okay, again, what's the bottom line? Who's being blessed ultimately?
Everyone.
Okay, great. Now, I want to suggest a different question. Okay, instead of asking what's the bottom line, let's ask how does this midrash function? And what is it telling me in the way that it functions? Okay? You want to ready to respond?
Go ahead. You mean free Jewish men, them is everyone else.
Okay, so I think that's one of the toughest things about this midrash, just realizing how the rabbis read the Torah. That when it says you, it relates to a very small group of people, and it excludes a lot of us, okay? So that's tough. Okay, maybe important for me to realize if I ever want to become part of this tradition in any equal way, right, as a citizen. Okay, but that's a strong thing to notice. And if I'm interested only in the bottom line, I'm not going to notice that. Okay, I have to ask how the exclusion functions here. Yes?
Can you explain how the Midrash works?
Which one of them?
Number 13?
13.
The proof, the core one is, the base case is,
mm-hmm.
which we're saying is a narrow definition.
Right? It means that when the...
Just you, not Girim, Nashim, and other
right.
Avadim. But then the proof text to include the larger is Atem.
Okay, so I want to go with me to the Hebrew a minute. Ve Atem lo tetzu, and you shall not go out. You have there a lot of words to add the women on with. Okay, so let's think a minute. What are the possibilities of how, it's here, we're grouped together, right, with everyone who isn't a full citizen. Slaves, strangers. What are all the possibilities of how to add in those that aren't the atim?
Why would we assume that they have to be added in? Why don't we assume, like, anachnu is all of us, and atim is you all?
I am with you. It's not me. It's the Midrash.
But why did they raise the question? That's what I'm asking you.
Really. So I think that is a great question. And all I can say is that I'm stuck with a tradition that asks the question. Okay? In other words, that learning these texts just makes me very aware of how exclusive the tradition is. And that means I have a lot of work. Okay? So I think... That's my initial response. It's why I think learning and interpreting these texts is important, Because I think that if I don't understand the mechanisms of exclusion, I won't be able to overcome them. Okay? And that's where I think Ellie's question is very important. Dina, you want to relate?
Go.
Yes, please.
The pasuk could have said just atem, but since the pasuk says v'atem and you, it's the and that includes all these other attributes. So I think that's the mechanism of the pasuk. And I just wanted to say something that includes these benefits.
Go ahead. Please, help me.
I feel the exclusion of, you know, the people who think that they're addressed by you is not me. But more than I feel excluded, I feel sad for people who think of themselves only as men and not as people, or people who think of themselves only as Jews and not as people. And I have some sort of compassion for how, I don't want to say difficult, but how specific it was to grow up as a rabbinic man at the time that you're reading this, that when you, that you like automatically assume such a narrowness in you. And you have to like wiggle your way into like a broader humanity. I feel blessed that that's not the way that I like hear things.
Great.
Can I clarify a question right now because I'm very confused about something?
Sorry. Responses? Yes, Ayelet.
In 13, in the attempt, in numbers 13 and 15, which is inclusive? Which is exclusive, because at different times I thought you said different things.
Right, so I think that goes back to the question that also Ravelli was asking.
Like,
so
are these including or are these not including the other?
Perfect. So now I'm going to do a elaborated read of both, okay, in the few minutes that I have left. You, I'm reading 13. You, whoever's writing this midrash hears, I have not but you. So the word you is exclusive. It doesn't include gerim, nashim, ve'avadim, strangers, women, and slaves. How do I learn those? From the words ve'atem lo tetzu. Dina suggested the vav, the and, which is a great word for including. Okay? It is. It's a perfect anchor for inclusive, for inclusiveness. I have to tell you, having learned this body of midrashim, that often the verb is also used to include. It's everyone who can go out. The tetzu, okay? So it's everyone who can go out. They serve here, right? They're not the direct people that the verse is talking to according to the Midrash, but they are part of those who leave, okay? Is that helpful?
So the atem is referring only to the Jewish
men?
Men.
Yeah, okay. But now I want to say why I think you're confused, Ayin. Because the bottom line is that women are included. They also left Mitzrayim, and Avadim are included. Slaves also left Mitzrayim, and strangers also left Mitzrayim together with those citizens. But my experience of learning this Midrash is of being excluded. Okay? And I think that's why we feel the conclusion. And the same thing is going to happen in 15, which I'll demonstrate in a minute. Yes.
They were all Avadim. That was the point. Wait. So, Lutheran asked him that would Avadim?
Nahon. You're right, and Dina or somebody here might remember in which Parashat Shavua I wrote about exactly that question, which is, it's very interesting to see a group of slaves already having such hierarchies, at least in their fantasy about who they are, okay, already imagining that then they had all these different social groups. Let's read 15 1 minute, and then we'll summarize. This is how you shall bless the children of Israel. I have not a blessing for Yisrael, and we all know that Yisrael doesn't mean Yerim, Nashim, Ve'avadim, strangers, slaves, and women. How do I know that they're included? Okay, so whenever the Torah says Bnei Yisrael, this person reading assumes that we're talking only about the men, and how do I include the women? Ve'ani avarchem. How do I include the slaves, the converts? Ve'ani avarchem. How here is the mechanism of inclusion? Yeah?
I think it's the verb again. It's the Yevarchem. I will actually bless. Like anybody who can receive a blessing.
Notice. So one possibility is the verb. Anyone who is able to be blessed or can receive a bracha. Great. Any other thoughts of what's the mechanism of inclusion here? Yes?
Maybe it's because the Ani is God.
So God, whereas we mortal people are very exclusive and discriminatory, God doesn't share that same quality.
Great. So I think that that's a second basic way to look at it, and that's a phenomenon that we see again and again, that the eye of God is inclusive, okay, which we can see as nechama, as comfort, and we can see as very distressing because it kind of limits the, it accepts that humanity, or at least Jewish humanity, is limited, okay? So now I want to say a few just words in summary. The first thing I want to say is still to just stay with these midrashim, and that is the element of choice. We, with our modern prism, are aware that there is a p'chira darshanit here, a element of exegetical choice to reading the word Yisrael, or the word you, as exclusive. Right? We can read it differently. We can read it as inclusive. And there is a commentator here who's making a choice when reading these texts. And let's put that on the table, okay? That we could choose different, maybe, okay? And there might be legitimacy to a different type of choice here.
But that's true of almost every comment since Sanhedrin forward, right? Like what needs to happen is a whole rereading of every single text, of every single commentary, of every single statement. Because nearly always, right, which is obviously not always, but more often than not, it's the case that it's men speaking to men for men, even about women.
So there's a lot of work, okay? You're right, okay? It doesn't mean that everything in our tradition is insignificant, okay? I think that's where there's, again, the work that we need to do. What are the biases that we need to clean? And kind of give them, Tamar Ross talks of a new nevuah, prophecy, okay? That there is ongoing prophecy, and maybe some of our new intuitions and understandings have to be understood in that way, and kind of as legitimate prisms to read everything else. But the fact that we are, this is how I think about it. Okay, we're a very we're a tradition that was created by people. Now, where's the challenge? People are Tzelem Elohim, so there's something divine in this tradition, and I think that that's part of the balance we all the time have to mediate. Okay, between those two, when we are rereading and trying to understand it to our world. Okay, this is what I want to say by way of summary. I showed four examples of interpretation or of reinterpretation. Each one of them also had a claim of content, not only of form, but also of content. For example, okay, when we opened with Chava, the call there was that there is a tool of rereading that can be centered on issues of relationships and of personal experience. And that those are prisms that can add and change the way we understand some of our traditional texts. There was a broad claim that our tradition can hold many voices. Okay, it can tolerate the multivocality and disputes. That's something very comforting. As I said, I believe that the Jewish community today is at arms about these issues, the issues of boundaries, the issues of what interpretations are in and what interpretations are out. And I believe that we all have a responsibility to define the way that we live in this context of the relationship between innovation and tradition. I think it's one of the most systematic and principled discussions that's taken place today, and that we have to justify both to ourselves and to the next generation and to our students the way we are living as internal to the Jewish prism. We have to justify the way we live our lives as Jews from a Jewish perspective. There's a loud discussion going on about who and what is in and who is and what is out. And many things are being put in question. And each one of us owes, as I said, both to ourselves and to the next generation and to our students, we owe answers both in the choices that we are making in this bridge between the past, the tradition, and the present, and also to enable our students to develop their own philosophies in this regard. Thank you.